seen a film about Forecast on 3RRR, and I'm very excited to see the reissue of some very important films from Australian film history by one of the pioneers, a director who made 9 features over a 30-year period. I'm talking about Charles Chauvel, and Umbrella are releasing the Charles Chauvel collection over the next few months, starting off with 40,000 Horsemen and The Rats of Tobruk. There's a screening this weekend at Acme. More about that later, but I've got with me in the studio Charles Chauvel's grandson, Rick Chauvel Carlson, and also John Doggett Williams, who is the director of a feature-length documentary called The Big Picture, which, in case you don't know much about Chauvel, this will fill you in. It's quite a massive undertaking in itself. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Charles Chauvel, when I was a kid, he was probably the quintessential example of the dreamer who went out to make a film industry when there really wasn't one. Growing up today, you don't know about this, but back in the, if you go back to previous decades, every time you made a film, it was, you were starting from zero again, weren't you? There wasn't, it was very hard to get government financing, and it was very hard to compete with the Americans.
That's correct. Actually, he was the country boy that became the mogul, I probably should say. And it's very interesting because, I mean, we did have a very fledgling film industry here in Australia until Hollywood cottoned on that it was actually going to be a very, very effective medium, and they ploughed millions of dollars into their studio system and they caught up. But of course, we made the first full feature length film in the world in 1906, which was Story of the Kelly Gang. But we were making more films than the United States earlier on, and then they caught up. But certainly my grandfather, the bug was bitten when he first met Snowy Baker, when he went down to Sydney to study art originally, and then saw what Snowy Baker was doing with silent movies and decided, well, I think this is rather what I'd be doing.
And ironically, Snowy Baker had a very successful career in Hollywood later.
Well, he did, yeah. He went over there and they decided, well, we want to keep you here, and they gave him a lot of money and decided, well, I think I'll stay.
And that was during the silent era.
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what Chauvel's films have in common is they explore Australia's national identity and the landscape, and he worked in the studio, but what he really loved doing was pushing himself almost to the point of endurance by quite often making films on very remote locations. And the tales behind the making of some of those films is almost as interesting as the films themselves.
I think that was the adventurist and the explorer within him. Yeah. But I think, you know, that was throughout his whole career. He was a real person, and he unless he had to do something in the studio, he preferred doing it on location.
And was he, how did he start making films? Was he self-taught? I mean, it's not like today, you go to a film school, you just pick up a camera. Was there something in the genes or in his DNA that...
Well, I think he had that artistic temperament, and he originally wanted to study art, and I think he saw the Australian landscape as a picture, and he wanted to portray that to the screen. When he originally followed Snowy Baker, well, I should say he started off by helping Snowy Baker in Bondi Junction, looking after the horses, and that's how he got into helping Snowy Baker with films, and then did a little bit of stunt work and so forth and bit parts. And then when he followed him to the United States, he actually stayed there on his first trip for about 6 months and watched what was happening over there, was involved with the Hal Roach Studios doing bit work. I've got lovely little photographs of him dressed up as an Arab and all sorts of roles that he was playing just to sort of pay the way. In fact, actually, even at one stage, he was selling vacuum cleaners and he was with his good friend Robert Emerson Curtis, who was a well-known caricature artist and painter in Australia, and he was writing articles for local papers. So they got by that way, but he learnt the film craft, came back, and in 1926 made his first two silent films, The Moth of Moonbee and Greenhide.
And he had the skills of a promoter, which you needed in those days, didn't he?
He was brilliant at promoting himself. He was the real raconteur, and he really knew how to drum up business for his films.
A key collaborator was his wife, Elsa. How did they meet?
Well, they met in an unsuspecting way. He saw her in a stage play. I think it was at the Cremorne Theatre, and she was captivating. And at the end of it, he said, look, you know, I really think you'd be suited for my next up-and-coming silent picture, and would you like to do a screen test? And by the end of the picture, they were engaged to be married.
You mentioned before about Hollywood's stranglehold on Australian production, exhibition and distribution, and a recurring problem he had was getting the films actually seen.
Yes, well, in the early days, he did have to basically go hand in hand with his cans of film to the each theatre and actually pay them to put his films on alongside with Tom Mix or whoever the player was of the day.
So he actually he was there for the transition from silent to sound?
Oh, definitely. In fact, actually all mediums. I don't think there's too many directors that have been able to go from the sound era, from the silent era through to the sound era, then on to colour film and then into television. And that's quite a big, broad spectrum.
Now, I've got to bring up the name Harry Chevelle, who's also, well, not a forgotten figure, but, you know, the Chevelle family. Mm. He was a great Australian horseman. And, of course, there's a direct connection here with some of the films that your grandfather made. What was the relationship there?
Well, General Sir Harry Chevelle started off in the lowly ranks, went to the Boer War, then Gallipoli, survived those two, and then worked his way up to being Australia's first general. And because of the exploits in Palestine in the First World War, when it came to making his first morale booster, which came at a very, very good time in Australian history when morales were low. And so he spoke to his uncle, the general, and was able to get inside knowledge and also get things to a factual state for his making of 40,000 horsemen.
Well, 40,000 Horsemen and The Rats of Tobruk were very successful films in World War II. And, of course, Hollywood was making lots of morale boosters.
Oh, definitely.
But Australia played its role too.
Well, I think my grandfather really believed that we had some exciting stories to tell in this country, and we were always seeing other people winning the war, whether, you know, it was their war or not. You know, the Americans were always winning the war, and he wanted to see Australians playing their part, and also, naturally, with that charge on Sheba, it was the last great cavalry charge. And a big turning point in that section of the campaign.
It would be remiss if I didn't ask you about Errol Flynn too. There's all these legends about Errol Flynn.
Well, you know, there's all these legends, and my grandfather discovered a lot of people who really, they were raw talent, but then ended on being, you know, very well successful film stars. With Errol Flynn, for instance, you know, he...
Was he a rat bag when your father first met him?
Well, look, apparently he caused a lot of trouble in the studios and was flirting with the girls, wouldn't turn up on time for rehearsal, and he wasn't the most polite individual. And, you know, you read stories about him in his early life and they're all true. He was a real rat bag. You know, he didn't really care for anyone else except himself. But there's lots of stories I can tell you. But probably the one that everyone likes to hear is, you know, how my grandfather actually discovered Errol Flynn. And it just happened that his parents owned a plantation, a copra plantation in Papua New Guinea, and he was sailing his yacht, the Sirocco, and somehow wrecked it or beached it on the Great Barrier Reef, and there supposedly was a photo of him dragging a gorgeous blonde ashore, and my grandfather's assistant director, Frank Warwick, had seen it in the paper, and anyway, they both tracked him down to the long bar at the Australia Hotel and said, look, we've seen you. You've obviously got a good speaking voice and you've got the right physique for the role of Fletcher Christian. Would you like to be in a movie? And they said, oh, I said, look, I'll give anything a shot. And then at the end of the picture, he approached my grandfather and said, look, do you think I've got a shot in the movies? Because I wouldn't mind doing this. And he said, well, look, if you go to the States or the UK, you might have a go there. And of course, a couple of years, two, 3 years later, I think he was in Captain Blood, you know, and that cemented his career.
Well, Captain Blood was 35. It was also the year of Mutiny on the Bounty, the big MGM hit.
That's
now, how did MGM feel when they heard about In the Wake of the Bounty?
Well, actually, what actually happened with that was that out of all the films that have been made on the Bounty, you know, Clark Gable, Marlon Brando, Errol Flynn, etc., none of them have been made on Pitcairn Island. And my grandfather in 1932 thought that this was the most daring thing to do, is actually go to the home of the Bounty mutineers. And he was the first camera crew, him and Tasman Higgins, that went there in 1932. And so they captured a time in history which we'll never see again, of a race of people that were, you know, spawn of the Polynesian women and the Bounty mutineers. And so he felt it was just an amazing story, along with also the dramatised dramatized version of the actual mutiny. And so, it's interesting, the whole story. But he travelled, you know, thousands of miles to get to Tahiti and then on to Pitcairn to film that. But actually, with the MGM version, they actually bought my grandfather's films, chopped out the all the acting sequences, and then put the documentary section of that film and used it as a trailer for their upcoming film.
Can be a bit of a double-headed sword, because MGM also don't want that film playing in opposition, do they?
No, they don't. So they actually changed all the audio and everything on there and used it as a bit of a propaganda tool to sell their upcoming film.
I might bring John Doggett Williams into the conversation, because looking at all the footage, especially in the documentary that accompanies the release of the individual films, one senses that must have been difficult to actually access some of this footage, because I don't know, especially Charles Chauvel being a one-off producer, it wasn't like they all came from one source. Dating back, you know, decades.
Fortunately, Elsa Chauvel and her daughter Susan, Rick's mother, were very organised with their archive, and most of the outtakes and shorts Rick either had or the NFSA had stored. So we sourced most of it from that. And in fact, I went up to Toowoomba where Rick's staying, and the archive's sitting there, and he gave me a roll of 16 mil that hadn't been developed yet from 1935. So we had the chance
Fantastic.
To do that
yeah.
sort of.
There's even a bit of, you know, behind the scenes footage on the sets of some of those films.
Yeah, well, as you said before, Charles was very conscious of promotion, and in the '20s with the early films, he ran beauty contests and gave everyone sold the Hollywood dream to Australian women and actors. You know, it can happen here too, and that was.
And they thought that was great. They thought, oh, we can have a shot too. We can be a Hollywood star too.
And
so
he really played on that, and he was conscious of doing those film promotions, which were, as you know, they're not like now where you're sort of knocking out trailers and promos and everything's a lot of work to do in those days. And that's one of the things about Chauvel. His story is very relevant to today's filmmakers. We've got access to amazing technology, and you can go out and follow your dream, tell your story.
But the battle's still the same, isn't it?
Faced distribution.
Yeah.
Getting people to see what you've done.
Yeah.
But Chauvel wouldn't take no for an answer, and he was relentless, as you said. I'm glad that it comes across in the documentary. They went to extremes. You know, he was the ultimate freelance journalist, which is a career I've pursued. He'd go out to the outer edges. He'd go to Pitcairn, first camera on Pitcairn Island, wasn't it? Your mother was the first white woman on the Australian.
My
woman
grandmother, yes, my grandmother was the first Australian white woman to ever land on Pitcairn Island.
And then they got stranded there, didn't they? When the boat forgot to pick them up.
Yes.
For another 2 months.
You've been back to Pitcairn.
I have been back to Pitcairn. My mother has too, and she wrote a book in 1998 called Pitcairn Island at the Edge of Time, which naturally talks about the story about Errol Flynn and the whole movie in section, but it also goes into actually Pitcairn Island in quite amazing amount of detail, you know, about how their economy runs and how the people have survived for 200 years, and it's an amazing book. And I was fascinated in seeing how things had changed since my grandparents had been there. And there was even one person on the island that vaguely remembered my grandfather being there when he was about 10 or 12. So
you're listening to Film Buffs Forecast, and with me in the studio, Rick Chauvel Carlson and John Doggett Williams, and we'll be back in just a moment to continue this conversation.
Check this out. I've got this, the coolest invention. First, you just kind of step right out of the shower and you slap this baby on. You're ready for your date.
Mary Tobin presents, direct from Canada, Marty Putz finally returns, back with his brand new comedy show, Very Weird and Slightly Dangerous.
I'm feeling good right now, baby.
Flying hamsters, exploding suits, weird inventions and huge marshmallow fights make up this high-energy, family-friendly visual spectacle. Described by the New York Times as a rarity to be treasured, Marty Putz plays the famous Spiegel tent at Fed Square until April 6th. Tickets through comedyfestival.com.au. Mary Tobin presents, Triple R sponsors.
Frankenstein is the latest work from The Rabble, the company acclaimed by critics for producing theatre no one else dares to make. Presented by Malthouse Theatre,
Frankenstein is a visceral and bravely striking mutation of Mary Shelley's gothic novel for a world once unimaginable, one in which life can be conceived in a laboratory instead of a womb. Frankenstein is now playing and must close April 5th. Tickets on sale now at malthousetheatre.com.au. Triple R sponsors.
Welcome back to Film Buffs Forecast, and with me in the studio, Rick Chevelle Carlson and John Doggett Williams, and we're talking about the Charles Chevelle collection. And I should point out right from the get-go that there is a special screening taking place tomorrow afternoon at Acme. And can you give me the details, because this involves a Q&A and a screening.
Yeah, 3:30 at Acme in Federation Square. Now, at the moment, it's hidden by the Spiegel tent out the front door. There's a screening of our documentary, The Big Picture, the films of Charles Chevelle, which is going to be on an added extra on all the Chevelle film re-releases. And we'll do a Q&A, Rick and myself, after the screening of that. And then that's followed by Rats of Tobruk, Chevelle's 1944 classic featuring Peter Finch, Chips Rafferty and...
Grant Taylor.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this, all the emphasis on Errol Flynn as a major Hollywood star, but other stars of Australian screen came out of the Chevelle films.
That's correct, and we've just mentioned Peter Finch, of course. He had done radio acting before. And
he makes a beautiful speech.
And he has. He's got a well-spoken voice. But, you know, you see Peter Finch on the screen and there's a certain presence then, you know, you know that he's going on to greatness, you know. And of course, then you've got Chips Rafferty, the laconic Aussie character, which typifies that type of Australian in those days, you know. And he went on to making other films like The Overlanders and Smiley and so forth. But this was really his first major screen debut, and Chevelle gave him that shot, and he did a really great job and did a lot of improvising through that film. You know, there were certain scenes which he felt that would be better if he'd done it a certain way, and so he would always say, look, how about I try this, and normally it would work.
And also it established the screen persona of Chips Rafferty, and he played a knockabout larrikin. There was a plummy voice. That's, or whatever, and that would have been a novelty at
that exactly.
time.
Yeah, it was, and it brought a bit of humour into the film, and my grandfather liked to have a hard-hitting film, and he liked to have a little bit of humour that would sort of soften that a little bit. Now, unfortunately, Rats and Tobruk has probably gone a little bit too far in that one, because my grandfather sort of, his arm was a bit twisted because he had to follow the guidelines of his backers, and they definitely wanted to have the comedy routine and the love interest in there, and he really didn't want to have that in there, but he realised that if he didn't, he wouldn't get the funding and the backing. And this was always the problem, that you sometimes have to be a little bit... willing to give up
It was the only Australian feature made during World War II.
Oh. And that's because a lot of production was given over to the war effort, wasn't it? And Chevelle himself made a few...
And film stock was a real problem.
That's right, yes. Well, he survived through the war years by making documentary films for the Department of Information. Yep. And then once that had finished, he was doing Rats of Tobruk. He was able to get quite a lot of assistance through the army and use the same characters again, Grant Taylor and Chips Rafferty in some of those documentaries as well. So they were looking for work, and they were readily available anyway.
Well, Grant Taylor was another star of the time, and... it's kind of alluded to, I think he had a bit of a self-destructive urge.
He did. You know, he could have actually, you know, I mean, there was another character that could have gone on to making a very successful career, but he was very self-destructive, and unfortunately not much really happened after that.
On a sadder note, Michael Pate makes the point, this again towards the end of the documentary, that eventually he has the theory that Charles Chevelle basically burnt himself out.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
He didn't take it easy growing old, did he? He was on to the next projects, and these were quite logistically demanding.
Stress.
Oh, my mother actually said that. She said that he was a very, very stressful person, and and she said that's no wonder that, you know, he had a massive heart attack. Yeah, he pushed himself and pushed himself, and he always had to outdo himself. And if someone said he couldn't do it, well, he had to prove it to them and prove it to himself that he could do it. It was like a personal challenge with himself. Mm-hmm. And also, I think he really believed in what he could do, and believed in that we could actually have a film industry in this country, and that we had a voice.
Mm. One of my favourite films is Sons of Matthew, which came out not too long after Second World War, and that was suffered from all kinds of calamities, you know, the weather and, you know, again, remote locations.
That's one of my favourite films too, and yes, it was at a time when I think they had the largest rainfall in 40 years, and they had the problem of all the kids being up there and being had to have... remote school teaching.
And this is up in northern Queensland?
Lamington Plateau, hinterland of the Gold Coast. And very inaccessible in those days. And fortunately, my grandfather was able to get assistance through the Queensland government to seal the road up there. And that made future access for the O'Reilly's guest resort.
And released in America as The Rugged O'Riordans?
Yes, well, he was very disappointed about that. A lot of times with my grandfather's titles, they were given different titles overseas, and he always felt that it sounded like an American baseball team.
John, can you talk a bit about this documentary? Because I was so impressed by it. I mean, on DVD extras, you see things that are documentaries and they're really sort of like short puff pieces. But this is actually a feature documentary, and it's quite detailed and comprehensive. It must have taken a lot of work.
Well, yeah, they all take a lot of work. And I just felt that, well, apart from anything else, Chevelle's should be a revered name, and he should be much better known. And I just, this story... You know, just scratch the surface and it jumps out at you. And it's so much fun. It's a great privilege to be able to re-edit, the charge scene out of 40,000 Horsemen, and so some of those scenes out of Sons of Matthew and in Jeddah, which is just breathtaking at different stages, and just seeing the social issues that must have jumped out at Chevelle. And it's such a great story. And of course, I'm aware of my peers. I know that everyone's going to look at a piece like this, and I just wanted to pay tribute and do the right thing by Chevelle, because I think this is the first documentary for at least 35 years since the Action Director. And also, Susan just passed away, Rick's mother.
Yep. And she's featured extensively.
Yeah, she's the main. She's the spine interview. Thanks so much to the NFSA and Graham Shirley's great interviews with her and Michael Pate. That's they're now the value of those interviews of getting them at the time is there. He died in 1959. So pretty much everything's been said. It hasn't been said for 40 years, and it's time that. He was brought back. Well, and young filmmakers need to know about this guy. He's a man of his time. His values don't always match ours, but in so many ways they do as well. And his spirit's he was amazing. He was an amazing horseman. Rick mentioned his time with Snowy Baker, but he didn't mention that for 2 months he was his stooge, which meant that Snowy was famous for the Sydney Flash. He was an expert whipcracker. And the way that Chevelle got to Hollywood was to follow Snowy and work with him, and working with him meant that he was the stooge who stood there with the cigarette lit cigarette in his mouth and the candle on his head. So Snowy could flick them out of his mouth and off his head from 20 feet.
And he did it for 2 months.
Well, Chevelle's last great masterpiece, flawed though it is maybe by today's standards, Jeddah, but I mean, who else was even interested in telling stories like this? Can you talk a bit about the circumstances of how Jeddah came together?
Well, Jeddah's an interesting film, because maybe in some ways it probably should never have been made, but I think how it started out was that on one of my grandfather's trips to the United States, a journalist had flagged him down and said, look, have you made a picture about your own indigenous people yet? And he went away and thought about it and thought, well, no, we haven't really. And he basically wove three true stories that were happening in the territory at that time, and that's what Jeddah is today. And it's a complex film in some ways, and I think my grandfather really felt that the Aboriginal people weren't understood properly, and that they were being catapulted into a white society way too quickly. Mm. And when people saw that film, it really shocked a lot of people. It was very, very confrontational, and many people spoke about that film for years to come. But technical problems, it was like a lot of my grandfather's films, especially later on, things became more difficult as time went on, especially in the 50s. There was just no funding, and my grandfather came up against the brick wall with Jetta. He had to found his own company, and it was very difficult to get any backing at all, because it was just not a subject that people wanted to touch. And also the Australian film industry was going into a big decline after the Second World War. Yeah. It was just going into a big decline, and after my grandfather died, well, as you know, nothing was really happening until the 70s.
Like, it's a terrible thing to say, but if your grandfather had lived into the 1960s, that was the worst decade of all for Australian films.
Well, it was. And my mother always used to say that possibly he might not have been making any more feature films just because of the climate, but he probably would have been concentrating more on documentaries and so forth, and I'll get to that. But with Jetta, because of the harsh landscape and the temperatures and the remoteness, it was such a very, very difficult film to make. Mm. And just keeping the film stock cool was an arduous task. I mean, at the end of the day, they'd have to wrap the film in Hessian during the day, I should say, put it under rock crevices to keep it cool, and then at night they'd pack it in ice, take it to the butcher, and then the butcher would then take it to Darwin Airport and put it on the next flight to England, because at that stage there was really only colour laboratories the closest was the colour laboratories in Denham in England, and so they'd have to wait 3-4 weeks before they got back any word on reel number 2, reel number 6, whether it was any good, and a lot of times it wasn't, and so they'd have to reshoot that scene again. It's not like today where we have instant gratification on what we've taken and we can rectify it straight away, you know, so 6 weeks is a long time. Mm. And there was one instance where a young camera assistant had threaded the film in the wrong way, and they lost about 6 weeks of film because, he'd stuffed up, you know, and that was a big blow to my grandfather, because that's a lot of money, you know, that's 6 weeks out of your, out of your budget. And so he got sent packing back to Sydney.
Well, this was actually Australia's first colour feature in 1955, and it played at Cannes.
It did. It was the first film to be represented at Cannes for the Palme d'Or. And, I think we should be very proud that Australian flew its flag for the very first time there.
Yeah, and this is a kind of a trivial point, but it's something that's always fascinated me. It was shot in a very unusual colour process.
Well, it was. My grandfather had been up to the Territory on many reconnaissance trips, but especially for Jetta. He was trying out all different types of film stock, and Kodachrome was just too garish. It was just with the harsh conditions of the Territory and those really stark colours of the blue skies and the red dirt, and it blew everything out. It was saturated. So he had to start looking, and there was this film stock at the time called Gave a Colour, which was a Belgium film stock, and so he was trying with that. And the first tests were fantastic. It really toned everything down back to more of a natural colour. But unfortunately, it wasn't tested film stock, and 4 years later, all the prints had faded back to magenta, and they were all wrecked.
But it's since been restored.
Well, interesting. What happened in the 70s was that my grandmother, Elsa, with the help of some people were able to find the original tri-separation prints, the colour prints, and then with the original negative, they were able to somehow lift the print off and lay down those three colour tri-separation prints to form a brand new print, which then they converted to 35mm. And then, of course, now we've got the high definition transfer just in the last few months, so that's really terrific.
The other artistic challenge of Jetta was that obviously to do service to this story, you were going to have to use non-professionals.
That's right. I mean, that was my grandfather's problem all the way through his problem, because we didn't have film schools like we do today. You know, we're very fortunate, that we've got afters and NIDA and so forth, but there was none of that there. So you either had to find people who worked on the stage, which sometimes was a bit stagey, so to say, or you had to find raw material. And I think my grandfather actually chose to go for raw material most times because he got more of a natural outcome from that. And then some were just really amazing. And so with Jeddah, Robert Tuttawally, his real name was Bob Wilson, but Robert Tuttawally, who was...
I never knew that.
Yes, Bob Wilson was his was his name, yeah. But he played Tuttawally in the film. And, he's just one of those gems. You know, he was just a natural and he had a presence on the screen and he commanded the role that he played. And he's magnificent in that. And he could have gone on to being a wonderful actor and a voice for the Aboriginal people. And unfortunately had an untimely death before he could do that. But yes, Jeddah was one of those amazing films.
And the female lead became a nun?
She did, and then ended up being an advocate for her own people up in Alice Springs. Yeah, Rosalie
Kunoth.
Yeah.
Her name in the film was Nala, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
But that wasn't her real name, was
no,
Rosalie?
No, her real name was Rosalie, yeah. Rosalie Kunoth, and then later Rosalie Kunoth Monks. It's...
The final film activity of the Chevelles was a series of nature documentaries for the BBC. Was this frustration because he couldn't get features up, or was it just an opportunity? I'll go into this.
What it was definitely bread and butter, because after Jeddah everything just shut down completely, and I think actually there weren't too many people that wanted to give Chevelle a film because Jeddah was so controversial, and certainly the government didn't want to. But I think probably the main thing was the film industry had just bottomed out completely. It wasn't a good time. And then when the BBC approached Chevelle and said, we'd like you to they had seen Jeddah and they had seen his films, and they wanted to do something very similar on the Michaela Dennis type husband and wife show. And so they commissioned him to do 13 half-hour documentaries for the BBC, and they covered a lot of aspect from industry to, from the flying doctors to school of the air to buffalo hunting to station properties. And so it gave people in Britain a bit of a sense of who we were as people. It was definitely targeted to a British audience. And that's what really kept, I guess, paying the bills through that middle part of the 50s after Jeddah, because he lost a lot of money with Jeddah. In fact, with a lot of films he did, unfortunately, most times a lot more people saw the money than what he did. And on the morning that he had a massive coronary heart attack, he was actually talking to people and investors about a Pacific Island walkabout series. So he was always thinking of new ideas and thinking of new pictures, whether they came into fruition or not. And at home there's quite a lot of scripts, unfinished scripts, full scripts of films that never came to be.
Are we lucky to be able to say definitively that all his films have been preserved? There weren't any that were lost?
Oh, not at all. I should say that with the silent films from 1926, with both of them, there are sections from Moth of Moonbeam and Greenhide which are missing, so they're not quite complete. I mean, they were nitrate, and the fact that actually about 90% of our silent movie film history is lost.
Mm.
We made so many films
there
in Australia, and there's not many left
to be found now.
No, which is quite sad. And so they were a very flammable film stock, of course, nitrate, and it's sad to say, but they're not complete. But certainly with all the rest of his films, definitely.
Mm. So what do you think his lasting legacy is going to be?
Well, hopefully these, the DVDs. I mean, the fact that they're now available for the first time on DVD, they were available on VHS about 15 years ago, but now they're available, and I just hope that this...
I'm really clear about what his lasting legacy is. It's an attitude and a determination to make film.
The Festival of German Films, orchestrated by the Goethe Institute Australia.